What's up with that?
There were many wars in Jewish history, especially in ancient times. Yeshua, King David. Did the armies keep shots in Yom Tov during the wars?
Well, it's interesting, you know. Let me first say, in Tanakh, we don't have a direct answer to that question. In the Book of the Maccabees, which is not part of the Jewish Bible, but it's called the Apocrypha, and the story of the Maccabees, of course, is during the Second Temple, it is actually recorded that the Maccabees did not fight on Shabbos, but the enemies attacked them as a result, so the rabbis gave them permission to fight on Shabbos. So it seems to be that there were actually armies that were machmer not to fight on Shabbos, and the psak was, it's pikuach nefesh, an enemy wants to destroy you. So what was the minhag in the time of David HaMelech, we don't know, but as the general rule, you don't aggressively wage war on Shabbos, but if an enemy is actively attacking you, it is pikuach nefesh, and pikuach nefesh, of course, overrides Shabbos. So we would assume that at least in the middle of a battle, they would fight even on Shabbos.
How did that apply to the beginning of the Six-Day War when Israel ripped apart the Egyptian Air Force in a surprise attack? If it seemed like that was prudent and it was better to do it sooner rather than later, and Shabbos was the earliest they could do it, would that be okay? Because that's an aggressive attack.
Yeah, yes, it is okay because that is the din of Rodef, right? The din of Rodef says that when someone is trying to kill you, you kill them first. Now, if you have to wait until they actually attack, then you're going to lose lives and the like. So the notion of preemptive attack in order to avoid future danger does allow and even require desecration of Shabbos if there was no alternative to that. Meaning to say, if they had an equal opportunity to do it on Friday or do it on Sunday, then they have to wait, halachically, not that the Israeli army has any questions. But if indeed Shabbos was the earliest, and if they wouldn't have done it on Shabbos, they would be exposing themselves to danger, then the halacha would be that that's also pikuach nefesh. Pikuach nefesh applies to preemption as well as actively fighting somebody that's hitting you. Right? That's the din of Rodef. Habal lahargecha, someone is coming to kill you. Hashkein v'harov lo, you are allowed to kill them. Kill them first. Yeah.
I was wondering if the Rav could tell us, do the laws of Yichud and Shomer Negiah change for homosexuals?
That's a very fascinating question. As we know, the laws of Yichud say that men and women cannot be alone because they may come to improper sexual relations. So the question about gay people is really twofold. Can a gay man be with a woman? In other words, lakula. Maybe there's no Isser Yichud because there'll be no sexual attraction. There, I can tell you the answer is the halakha still applies because we don't differentiate, in other words, some type of man from other type of men, meaning to say it would be confusing. A man could be alone with a woman if he's gay and not if he's straight, and that would be not shaykh. But the question is raised the other way around. Will I be machmir with yichud of men and men? Men and men, right? In other words, two gay people, or maybe even one gay person with another non-homosexual. And the question is going to be, if I looked at the logic of the prohibition of yichud between men and women, then logically it ought to apply to men when there's homosexual attraction. On the other hand, you know, we don't have a koach to add on to rabbinic enactment. So it's one of those things where even if logically the law should apply, Chazal did not apply the halacha. So I would say this. I would say, therefore, that it is not a formal iser. It is not a formal prohibition, but the logic of it would indicate that if you had a religious homosexual, there is such a thing, although it's a kind of a contradictory, a religious homosexual should not be alone with a man, but that's more of a private gezeira, not a chazal gezeira. By the way, we saw Salanter, actually Paskins, this is very strange, that there's an iser yichud to be in the same room with somebody else's money. Because he makes the point that the Gemara says that the Eitz Hara of theft is even greater than the Eitz Hara of sexual arayos. So Yisrael Salanter said, if Chazal are afraid, you'll come to improper sexual relationships. Kal v'chomer, you'll come to improper theft. So he actually held, you're not allowed to be alone with somebody's money in the room because you might steal it. That's what he said. And people are also discussing, should there be an issue yichud with the internet? If you don't have a filter, you should have a filter. Because, you know, If you're all by yourself in the room, not that you're going to do anything with the computer per se. We're not talking about that. But you may go to places where a person is not supposed to go, and maybe it's good to have a guard there, a shomer there. Right? So these are not. I can't call these halakas because we don't have the koach to add on to the gezeiros of Chazal. But this would be going beyond the letter of the law to live by the spirit of the Torah. So it actually does make sense. Yeah.
The Arab rub, did they convert and was it a small minority and what exactly happened?
Yeah, there's a big machlokas. The Arab rub is described in the Torah as the riffraff, so to speak. Arab rub, the mixture of people that Egyptians, and maybe other nations, that left with the Jews when they left Mitzrayim, and there were a huge number. We don't really have their number, but some say, the number of the Arab rab was even larger, amazing, than the number of Jews who left Mitzrayim. We know the number of Jews were 603,000 men from 20 to 60, and then there were women, and then there were people below 20 and above 60. Then you had a huge Arab rab. Did the Arab rab become Jewish? Did they experience Matan Torah and the like? There seems to be different opinions in Chazal about it. The Vilna Gaon seems to understand that the Arab rab did convert to Judaism and they became part of Klal Yisrael, but because their motives were not L'shem Shamayim and were not pure, a lot of the spiritual problems in Klal Yisrael come from the Arab rab, meaning to say, we are mixed in with the Arab Rav, and that causes the Sinas Chinam, and that causes the Avodah Zarah, and everything else. So in a way, the Vilna Gaon says, don't blame the Jewish people, it's the Arab Rav that made us bad in that way. So the Vilna Gaon seems to be assuming that the Arab Rav did assimilate within Klal Yisrael, which means they came to Israel. Now, there is a bit of a problem. It's a Dover Pashut that the Arab rab did not get a portion of the land of Israel, because no convert got a portion of the land of Israel. Eretz Yisrael was divided only among the Jews, per se, who left Mitzrayim as Jews. So that would mean you'd have a huge population that really didn't own any land. So we don't have all the details about that. Eventually, how they settled, where did they live, we don't know a lot. They seem to have disappeared from being talked about after Yetzias Mitzrayim. But the Vilna Gaon says that at least a number of them did survive within Am Yisrael as a very bad and negative element. Yeah.
The difference also tells us that we have to have Das in God's existence. So as I understand it, Das means like an experiential knowledge as opposed to a more rational based knowledge. So what is experiential knowledge of God and why is that going to be any better than a more rational based knowledge?
Well, that's first of all a big machlokish. In the Aseret HaDibros, the first of the Aseret HaDibros is Anechi Hashem Elokecha, I am the Lord your God who took you out of Mitzrayim. The Rambam says that's a mitzvah saseh. That is one of the 613 mitzvahs. Well, the question is, it's not a mitzvah, it's a statement. What is it a mitzvah? So the Rambam says this is a mitzvah of emuna, a mitzvah to believe in God. Ramban asks on the Rambam, how can Hashem command that you believe in him? If you already believe in him, you don't need a commandment. I believe in him. If you don't believe in him, then who has the authority to tell you to believe in him? If I go to over an atheist and I say, believe in God, and the atheist says, why? He says, because God said so. I don't believe in God. There's no God telling me. So Ramban argues it's logically impossible for there to be a mitzvah called emunah. Emunah is not a mitzvah, says the Ramban. Emunah is the yesod. Emunah is the prerequisite. Emunah is the prerequisite and yesod of all of the mitzvahs in the Torah. But the question is, Rambam does count it, right? So what does the Rambam do? So what is explained is this. Now, this will be a long answer to your question. What is explained is that the mitzvah of Emunah, according to the Rambam, is not directed to the non-believer. It's not possible to command the non-believer to believe. It's directed to the believer through Messiah. If I believe in God because my parents taught me, I'm mechuyev to make it a rational, logical process by exploring. So the emes is, the Rambam does use the Lashon Leida to know, but the Rambam does not mean it in the Kabbalistic way. The definition you offered that it's experiential knowledge, I think is a Kabbalistic use of yediyah. In the Rambam's term yediyah, it is very much an intellectually based knowledge. According to the Rambam, one is obligated to investigate the philosophical ideas of God and convince themselves of their rationality. Now, in Hasidus and in Kabbalah, you find Bedafka, what the Rambam held was the highest level of faith, of Emunah, was considered to be a lower level. That in Hasidus and Kabbalah, they actively discouraged trying to intellectually convince yourself of the presence of Hashem. Part of it was just the practical danger that if you open up a Pandora's box, if I believe in Hashem, and now I'm told, let's explore the philosophical arguments, God forbid, I may lose my faith, right? So it's a very dangerous idea. So they substituted, instead of intellectual faith, they substituted the notion of emotional faith. Now, how do you get emotional faith? What does emotional faith mean? What does experiential faith mean? In a sense, you can't really tell a person how to get that. But it's the feeling that Hashem implanted in our neshamas, that there is a creator, there is a beauty in the world, there's a pattern in the world, there's a oneness in the world. And instead of focusing on the formal logic of a syllogism, one tries to be open to the beauty of the world and the unity of the world and the organization of the world. And in a sense, that engages the emotion. Now, it's a subtle distinction, because even in emotional faith, there's an intellectual component of pattern recognition and everything else. But the reason why it's superior is that when a person is convinced of an idea only in their brain, it does not yet motivate them to be willing to give their life for it. And it was pointed out by one of the great Gedolim that during the Spanish Inquisition, those Jews who were philosophically minded, their connection to God was based on philosophy, they tended to be the first ones to convert to Christianity when their lives were threatened. And the Jews that had a simple faith that was not based on philosophy, they were willing to give their lives. You know, so you got to be careful that sometimes when the Rambam uses a phrase of yediyah, it's not the same as Hasidus and Kabbalah, right? So the same word can mean different things. Yeah.
Where in the Torah do we find this, where like, still the kid, the son or the daughter is Jewish from a mother, not from the father?
Yeah.
Because keeping in mind what happened in the Holocaust, where a lot of women were raped, and you know, they had to know what the status of the kids were, so they found it from the mother. So where in the Torah is it, can we link it from?
Yeah. The question is, where in the Torah do we see that Judaism is passing through the mother and not through the father? And again, it's a little paradoxical, because tribal status, Kohen, Levi, whatever Shevet you are, is passed by the father, not through the mother, right? So in Judaism, we do have a lot coming from the father, but the basic idea, are you Jewish or not Jewish, right, that we all know comes from the mother. Well, it is a drasha of Chazal. It's a little bit of a complicated drasha. When the Torah says, do not let your daughter marry one of the seven nations of Canaan, because if your daughter marries one of the seven nations of Canaan, that man will cause your grandchild to be led astray from God. Now the Gemara says, how come the Torah doesn't give you the opposite scenario? Do not let your son marry the daughter, because she will lead your grandchild astray. Since the Torah only says if your daughter marries the guy, your grandchild will be astray, the implication is, if your daughter marries the guy, the kid is still Jewish and he's your grandchild. Implying that if your son marries the Goyish daughter, it won't even be your grandchild, right? That's kind of a diuk from the fact that the Torah is concerned only with the Jewish son of the Jewish mother and not the son of the non-Jewish mother. So it's kind of a drasha based on that. Now it's interesting, Ramban says, an interesting point, Ramban says, do you remember in the Torah, we have the story of the man who curses Hashem, and the Torah says he was the son of an Egyptian man and a Jewish woman, and they didn't know what the halacha was, and they put him in jail until Moshe got the halacha that you're supposed to stone him. Ramban says the reason they didn't know was that before Matan Torah, Judaism passed through the father. And therefore, as a result, they weren't sure that since this kid was born before Matan Torah, maybe halachically he would be an Egyptian and wouldn't have the same punishment. And the answer is, we go retroactively, even somebody born before Matan Torah, once it's Matan Torah. So the Ramban actually says that the original halacha was through the father, and then Matan Torah changed it to the mother.
I understand that one of the reasons the Gemara is as complicated as it is to encourage soldiers to toil in it and to refine their lives. But Gemara is the way it is because of persecution, induced loss of Musar. So did pre-Mishnah Jews also toil in Torah? If so, how? And how did they refine their lives without Gemara?
It's an interesting question. The simple explanation would be that I don't think it's entirely true to say that the need for the mental exertion and the mental toil is only a function of lost Masorah. I think that's certainly partially true, but it's not totally true. Because your assumption presupposes that Hashem gave Moshe a specific halachic ruling on everything, and therefore if we have to reconstruct it by reasoning, we lost something. That's not necessarily the way it works. For example, what did Hashem tell Moshe about microwaves or electricity or about surrogate motherhood, about land for peace? I would suggest, based on the Drasha Saran, that God told Moshe nothing about those matters at all, but God gave Moshe the principles out of which future Chachamim can figure that out. And therefore, a lot of the Gemara is not a question of reconstructing lost tradition. It is a question of applying the Masorah to the new Shilas that come up. As a result, therefore, even in the time before the Mishnah, there was constantly a need. Things always happened, and there was a need to take the principles and apply them, and that sharpened the mind and everything else. You see what I'm saying? In other words, your question was assuming that whatever we need to reconstruct was because we lost an answer. I'm suggesting there may not have been an answer. Hashem said, take the principles and work it out. That's one approach. However, there's no denial that the bulk of the people of Torah Shebal Peh, the Tanoim Amoraim, are post-second Beis HaMikdash. In other words, you don't find that much. David HaMelech had a Shiloh. The Gemara sometimes tells us that David HaMelech, had a Machlokes, had to learn the Pshat and something. So Rav Tzadok suggests that during the Bayis Rishon, when there was prophecy, our connection to the will of God came through more of a prophetic mode, in which, even if it wasn't a specific halakha Moshe Mi-Sinai, we perceive things in a more intuitive way. Now, how that sharpens our mind, I don't know, but in a sense, you didn't need those talents because you perceive the truth of God by a kind of Ruach HaKodesh and intuition. And it is only in the darkness of Golos that we need to use our minds in that particular way. Rav Kook, the great Rav Kook, says that this is actually a difference between the Bavli and the Yerushalmi. Now, again, most of us don't learn Yerushalmi that much. But we have two Gemaras, right? We have the Babylonian Talmud, which is the Gemara that most of us learn. And then we have the Jerusalem Talmud, the Talmud Yerushalmi. Now, they're both on the same Mishnah. They're both on the Mishnah, right? The Mishnah is only one Mishnah. And then you have a Yerushalmi Gemara and a Bavli Gemara. Now, one of the great differences between the Bavli and the Yerushalmi that anybody would notice right away, well, number one, the minor difference is it's a different dialect of Aramaic. So even if you know Babylonian Aramaic very well, the language of the Yerushalmi is a little different. It's not totally unfamiliar, but for example, Midrashim are that way too. If you ever open a Midrash, you'll find that maybe it'll get you a little depressed that, you can read a Gemara pretty well. Why can't you read a Midrash so well? Because it is a different dialect of Aramaic, and it's a different vocabulary. Okay, but that's relatively minor. But the main difference in Bavli and Yerushalmi is that the Yerushalmi is so much shorter. Yerushalmi will ask like one kasha on the Mishnah, give one teretz, and then go on to the next Mishnah. As opposed to the Bavli that may go pages and pages and pages. Rav Kook gave this explanation. It was really a very profound explanation. He said, there are two ways you can arrive at truth. Most of the time, we arrive at truth by a process of elimination. We consider many, many possibilities, and then we eliminate them. This can't be right, one by one by one by one, and whatever we couldn't eliminate got to be true. Whatever is left standing is truth. That's kind of truth by process of elimination of falsehood. There is another type of truth where you kind of just see the right answer right away. You don't need to consider alternatives. Instead of saying, well, maybe it's this, nah, it can't be that. Maybe it's this, nah, it can't be that, so I guess it's this. Certain intuitive, for example, even in science is that way. They say Einstein was a very intuitive scientist in the sense that Einstein didn't have to consider the other things. He just saw the right thing. So if Cook says, the Talmud Yerushalmi, because of its connection to Eretz Yisrael, had kind of a prophetic, intuitive grasp of truth. So it simply comes up with an answer. In the Babli, we have a Hava Amina, and we slug it up, and we have to prove it, and we have to do that and that. So in a sense, the notion of going through this laborious process of analysis, Rav Cook says, is connected to Gullus, where the intuitive light is hidden from us, and we need to go through this logical process. But the first point I made is an important point, and that is the pilpul of Torah Shebaal Peh is not exclusively a function of losing a Mesorah. Sometimes the Mesorah intentionally left it to the Chachamim to take the principles and apply them to new cases.
Why is it that alcohol drinking in the Jewish community is seen as socially acceptable, whereas smoking marijuana is seen as
Well, that's a good question. Of course, it depends what you mean by socially acceptable. I would think that, of course there are alcohol abusers in religious communities as well, and that's very, very true, and that's a very bad thing. But generally speaking, the issue is we would support alcohol in moderation, number one, because there are mitzvahs connected with alcohol, kiddush and the four cups of wine and rejoicing on Yom Tov. And David HaMelech says in Tehillim that wine is something that brings joy to people. So I wouldn't say that as a community, religious Jews endorse alcohol abuse, but they do say they do consider alcohol to have a place in Avodah Hashem. But your question is, okay, so why don't you have the same place for marijuana? Meaning to say, why can't we have marijuana use in moderation? The truth of the matter is, this is a debate in general society, because marijuana itself, the argument has been that unlike heroin, unlike cocaine, which are very, very dangerous drugs, even in small doses, some have argued marijuana in moderation, no problem. But in truth, there's a lot of things we don't know. Number one, the idea of gateway addictions is something that's very, very powerful, meaning to say, the average person, unless they have a propensity to alcoholism, which can exist, of course, does not get addicted with alcohol in moderation. Marijuana, we still don't know. And number two, there might be it's kind of a circular reason, but it's a reason to consider, and that is marijuana puts you into a community of drug users. And with drug users, these are people, in other words, who are going to be your friends and your colleagues when you take drugs? They will be people who may steal. They may be people who may rob. They may be people who may murder. There are people who may take very, very dangerous drugs, and they may destroy their brains and their abilities to think. Now, even if it's true that marijuana alone, in moderation, does not directly produce those effects, it puts you into a community where things could very, very easily escalate in a way that alcohol consumption in moderation does not. Now, I understand it's a little circular because part of why marijuana puts you in that community is because it's illegal and because regular people are not allowed to take it, which means if there would be normalization, maybe it could become like alcohol. I understand that. But given the reality of the legal system right now, putting aside the obligation to obey the law, I'm not even going with that issue of Dina Demochusadina, I think that drug culture is a reality. There is a culture of drugs. And by taking drugs, you become part of a drug culture. And even if the occasional ingestion of marijuana is not a per se such a destructive habit, and there I think the jury is still out on it, I think by becoming a member of that culture, you're setting yourself up for all sorts of destructive, evil things. My short answer is basically, maybe I shouldn't take this, is that putting aside the obligation to obey civil law, which is an issue, it's always an issue, there is nothing necessarily intrinsically evil or even forbidden about sporadic, occasional marijuana use. In other words, I would not look at a person and say, you are a Russia, you are an evil person. You're right, there's no reason to call a person that. But I think there is enough reasonable grounds that this leads to all sorts of bad things in terms of the people you'll hang around with and in terms of the introduction to other things, that even something that isn't so bad intrinsically should be avoided because of all of the baggage that comes in its way. I mean, that would be, I think, the short answer to it. Yeah.
I was wondering if Rav could give a background of Amir Lavoy, why it exists, or...
Yeah, this is a good question. All of us are very familiar with the rule that you're not allowed to tell a non-Jew to do anything on Shabbos that you wouldn't be allowed to do yourself. I cannot tell a non-Jew to turn on a light. I cannot tell a non-Jew to cook for me. Now, it's very, very clear that the non-Jew is committing no sin. There's no sin for a non-Jew to cook on Shabbos. So it's not... I'm causing a non-Jew to sin. He has no sin. In fact, he's supposed to desecrate Shabbos. If a non-Jew keeps Shabbos, he's chayav misa. But what is the sin? It's a rabbinic enactment. It's not a Torah commandment. The Torah basically says, I should not ask a non-Jew to do malacha because the chachamim viewed the non-Jew as my shaliach. Now, we know when it comes to shalichas, right, you're learning in Gittin, that my shaliach is like me. So when I ask a non-Jew to do something on Shabbos, at some level it's like I did it because he's my shaliach. But it's only rabbinic, and the reason why it can't be a Torah violation is, number one, there's no shaliach for averos. If I make, in other words, if I make you do an averah for me, it's not my averah, it's your averah. And there's another rule that a goy cannot be a shaliach for a Jew. So the concept that there's a concept of shalichas when a goy does malacha is certainly a rabbinic enactment. Now, because it's a rabbinic enactment, there are many, many exceptions to it, that the rabbis gave you certain leniencies. For example, if somebody is sick, I don't mean life-threatening. If it's life-threatening, even a Jew could violate Shabbos. But let's say I have the flu, I'm in bed, and I need somebody to pick up medication for me. I'm allowed to ask a guy to drive to the drugstore to pick up medicine. Or I'm allowed to ask you guys to turn off lights because I'm a chola. Another example, even if you're not really sick, if the heating broke down in your house and it's cold in the winter, I can tell a guy to turn on the heat or fix the heat because the Gemara says everybody gets potentially sick when it's too cold in the house. Now, an interesting shaila, what if you have an opposite problem, which might be more often in Israel? What if the air conditioning broke down and I'm schwitzing and I'm real hot? Can I tell a guy to repair the air conditioning? Maybe not, because people get sick when it's too cold, they get uncomfortable when it's hot, but they tend not to get sick, right? So I can tell a guy to repair the heat, I can't automatically tell a guy to repair air conditioning. Now, there's two halachas by Amir Eliakim. It's called Amir Eliakim. One is, you're not allowed to tell a guy to do malacha. The other is, even stricter, if a guy did malacha for you, even without you asking him, you're not allowed to benefit from what he did. Example, if a guy on his own made a cake for me on Shabbos, even if it's all kosher in my kitchen, I'm not allowed to eat it on Shabbos. If a guy turned on a light in a dark room, and I didn't ask him to do it, I'm not allowed to read in that room. Because I'm not allowed to benefit if the guy did it for him, for me. But if the guy did it for himself and me, let's say the guy turns on the light and he's going to read a little bit, then I'm allowed to read as well. If a guy heats up water for coffee and he's going to take a cup of coffee, I'm allowed to take that hot water for my coffee as long as I didn't ask him to do it. See, two different laws. One is I can't ask him. The other is I can't benefit from what he did unless he did it either for himself or for other goyim. One of the issues, which is a big issue, I'm sure you've heard of it, the Chazon Ish's famous psak, that we're not, in Israel, we're not allowed to use electricity. And, okay, that's a little bit, that's Jews doing malacha, but even in America, why am I allowed to use electricity? There are goyim who are mechalal Shabbos to produce electricity. The answer is, they're also doing it for other goyim, right? And therefore, a Jew can benefit. Israel is a separate question, because there you have Jews generating electricity, and that's why the Chazon Ish's psak, which most people do not follow, but some people do, is they will not use nationally generated electricity on Shabbos. They'll only use private generators, because they don't want to benefit from the Chilul Shabbos of Jews. But that's a different, that's not a Mira Liakim. Okay, now, a thing that a lot of people don't know is that telling a guy to do something that's forbidden is not only a law in Shabbos. It actually applies in other things as well. For example, I know this is a veterinarian question, that if I have a dog that needs to be spayed, the same way I cannot spay, I might not be able to ask a guy to spay it for me, because telling a guy to do something forbidden for me is forbidden, right? So it applies beyond the laws of Shabbos. I don't know if you had a particular question, but that's the general background. Yeah.
What about Yom Tov?
Yom Tov is the same thing. Now, one interesting question that exists in the internet age, or the time zone generally, is how does Amira Liakim apply when the guy is in a time zone where it's Shabbos, and in other words, either way, let's say in America, right? America, Shabbos starts 7 hours later. So can I tell a guy when it's not Shabbos for me? Let's say Motzei Shabbos, okay? Shabbos is over. Let's look at it. Motzei Shabbos is better. Shabbos is over for me in Israel. It's still Shabbos in America. Can I call my guy? Not my guy, my pet guy. Can I call my non-Jewish worker? I don't mean to be derogatory. Can I call my non-Jewish worker when Shabbos is over here? Shabbos is over here. And ask him to do something for me while it's still Shabbos in New York. I certainly could not do that with a Jew. I cannot, people say, can I email my parents? Certainly not. That for sure you can't do, because you're causing a Jew to desecrate Shabbos. But here we're not talking about causing a Jew to desecrate Shabbos. We're talking about having a goy do work. So many of poskim say, as long as it's not Shabbos for the Jew who's doing the commanding, he can have the goy do it even on Shabbos, or Yom Tov for that matter. Right, so that's an important thing to be aware of, that we don't care if it's Shabbos for the goy. We care if it's Shabbos for the Jew. That's the only thing that matters. Yeah.
As an extension of that question, you said that the difference between wine and marijuana is that the mitzvah connected to wine.
Yeah.
I believe that Knei Bosim is mentioned in the Torah, and mitzvah attached to that. So could you derive?
Well. Are you assuming a translation of Knei Bosim, that marijuana, is that what you said? Is it
completely separate to the cannabis that we know today? Is it not?
Do they translate Knei Bosim as cannabis? Because I've seen other translations.
Unless I'm mistaken,
well, I'm gonna have to check that in there. So you got high with the Katoris. That's interesting. I'm gonna check that. I honestly don't know. I've seen other translations for Knei Bosim. But it would be interesting. Let me ask you about marijuana. Again, I have no experience, and I don't want anyone to incriminate themselves here. I will be confidential. Do you get high by smelling marijuana? If you were to burn marijuana as incense, would that have an effect on you, or it's only if you? I guess that's inhalation. I guess it doesn't have to be a cigarette, or it doesn't have to be a brownie. You get it, I guess. If I were to burn marijuana just in the in as incense, would that affect me in any way?
I won't
ask how you know, but okay. It's interesting, you know, there is, in Kabbalah, there is actually a discussion of what you might call psychedelic aromas. In other words, there is, it's not so foreign, just as Lahavdil, of course, Indian tribes have peyote and various other ceremonies. Among the Mekubalim, among the mystics, and it's really based on the Avodah and the Beis Hamikdash, there was a concept of using various aromas to raise your consciousness in different ways. I think if we were to be totally honest, the use of some type of stimulant of that nature was not foreign to ecstatic Jewish worship. But you have to understand that this was always in a context that combined prayer, meditation, Torah study. These are things that properly could augment a person's spiritual sensitivities. But it never became like a hedonistic, voyeuristic obsession where that's all you were doing. And I probably, that goes back to my drug culture argument, that today it's been so severed from any connection to holiness that it would be very, very difficult to bring it back into that frame. But I think you have a good point, that at some point in our history it became part of the, it was part of a religious experience. Yeah.
Is there any situation where you can take a get out of the realm of a hoof and it actually becomes a skus? For example, there's this famous case now in America where a lady wrote to the New York Post about how much she really wants a get, and you know, if there's a real sort of she wants it, does it ever become a skus?
Now, are you saying is a chus for her or is a chus for the husband?
A chus for the, primarily in somebody else could acquire it for her and.
I'm not sure I understand what the problem is, because if she genuinely wants to get, you don't need it to be a zechus. She can make a shaliach. See, the issue of zechus is, can I act for the woman without her knowledge?
Yeah.
And there the Gemara says we treat get as a chov, and I can't. But if she really wants to get, you could avoid the whole issue. She can make a shaliach. You see what I'm saying? In other words, So your case would only be a case where we know she really wants to get, but she's not in a position to appoint a shaliach. It would be very, very difficult, because the way the Gemara defines chov and zechus is even if it's something she wants, but the very fact that a get does have a detriment, meaning it does take away some advantage, meaning she's not supported by the husband anymore, is enough to negate the rule of zachin liyadam. Zachin liyadam requires that it be 100% zechus. So I don't think we would do that. But on the other hand, if she makes a shaliach, it's going to be fine. Women make a shaliach all the time. That's called a shaliach lekabala, right? We have two types of shaluchim. The husband can make a shaliach to give the wife, and the wife can make a shaliach to receive.
Is there any halachas about quoting in line?
There are some halachas about it. First of all, the Derech Eretz is a halacha, the idea of not insulting people, not hurting people, not embarrassing people. But there's also a concept in the laws of theft. And that is, number one, if I butt in line ahead of you, then I'm causing you to get your food later or whatever it is. So I'm stealing some of your time. If you would be out of that line in a minute, and because of me, it's a minute and 30 seconds even, I have stolen 30 seconds of your life. And the Chavetz Chaim used to say, stealing time is a very, very serious offense, because stealing time is like murder, although we don't look at it that way, because what is my life but a succession of time? So I would say that stealing someone's place in line is a form of geneva, a gzela, and it would be usher for that reason alone. Now, in some yeshivas, Baruch Hashem, not our Sameach, but in some yeshivas, they actually have a system. It's kind of crazy, really, but there was such a system in some yeshivas where the older, more chashuv of people automatically got bumped into line. So if I was, let's say, in Kollel or whatever it is, and you're some beginner, I would just say, hey, got to move out of line because I'm more important than you. And for some Rosh Yeshivas actually thought that was a positive thing, because it encouraged respect for Torah and honor for Talmidei Chachamim. But I personally think that, at least for Bachram learning in yeshiva, that's not a good example, that they should not look to role models as people who are demanding kavod. They should look to role models for people who are not demanding kavod, right? So I would say it's even if you're more chashuv, you know, don't bump. Stay in your position in the line. Yeah.
Why does Judaism seem to look at rape so
roughly? It is a very excellent question. It's very, very surprising that a rapist gets away with a relatively minor sentence. We know that in many societies, rape is still including some places in the United States, rape is a capital crime. A person could go to death, he could be killed, electric chair, for raping. Again, it's funny, adultery is not a big crime in America, but rape is of a single woman, is a very, rape, single or married, is a great crime. Now, in Judaism, it's exactly the opposite. If a man commits adultery, and there are witnesses, etc., he could be executed, right, etc. On the other hand, of course, if he rapes a married woman, the same thing. But if the woman is single, what's the rule? A man rapes a single, an unmarried woman. So basically, there are a few things. There is a financial penalty that he pays, and it actually goes to her father, depending on her age. And in somewhat of a bizarre rule, from our perspective, he is obligated to marry the rape victim unless she says she doesn't want. She's not forced into it. Very strange. I mean, how many rape victims would want to marry their rapist? It's a very peculiar thing. And yet that's the right the Torah gives her, because she could claim she's damaged and no one's going to want to marry her, and the rapist got to make it up to her if she wants. If she doesn't want, of course, it's not forced. But in that case, the only penalty is financial. He doesn't go to jail. There's no jail generally. He doesn't get lashes, doesn't get malchus, and he doesn't get misa. So it would seem that the Torah treats rape in a relatively light way. You know, I think maybe you need to ask the question the other way. Why does society treat rape in such a serious way? I mean, meaning like this. If I break your arm, again, I don't want to be callous because I understand that rape is traumatic, but here's the question. If I break your arm, I don't get the death penalty for that, right? So the Torah views rape as a physical assault, a violent assault on a person. And b'derech klal, for violent assaults that are not homicide, the punishment is compensation. So in a sense, the Torah treats rape the same way it would treat hitting somebody with a baseball bat, in which you pay damages. So from a strictly logical standpoint, that's not so bad. I guess the question we have to ask ourselves is the other way. Why does society, secular society, treat rape so much worse than an assault? And I don't know. I mean, I can give reasons for that. But I think from the perspective of the Torah, rape is considered to be an aggravated, violent assault on a person, which it is. And the Torah basically says we apply the same punishments that we do to any other violent assault on a person, which is primarily financial. Right? So in a sense, from strict logic, the Torah is actually coming out the same, coming out in a consistent way. I'm sorry, was there a question there?
Well, yeah, I think there's a big difference here, because there's a substantial amount more of emotional distress that's caused with rape, and also you're dealing with more privacy in this particular context.
No, I hear what you're saying. Certainly, the physical pain of breaking an arm and being raped might be the same at some level, but there's a certain psychological invasion of intimacy that's a much more powerful in the case of rape than it is in some other things. No, I understand it. All I can say is I don't. Your question is a good question. I don't have a full answer, but I'm just thinking out loud with you, and just pointing out that the Torah classifies rape as violent assault, and therefore it, and in fact, by the way, that's how psychologists classify rape. They say rape is not sexual. Rape is violence. It does not come out of any sexual desire. A rapist is essentially a violent person, and the law of the Torah is making rape consistent with that. But again, I'll give some more thought to it and see what we come up with. All the way in the back. Yeah. Violence, yeah.
The man is still on his behalf is causing premarital relations. Is there no punishment for premarital relations anyway?
Your question is, even if they consented, they're doing premarital relations, shouldn't there be a sin? That's a big machlokes. Truth of the matter is, according to the Rambam, there can be lashes for any premarital relation, which is not rape per se. That would even be if they agree to get together. So according to the Rambam, that would be very true. You're 100% correct. A rapist would get lashes for that if there was warning. On the other hand, other opinions say there is no particular malchus for premarital relations. It's an improper thing, but it doesn't have a punishment. It's a spiritual sin, but it doesn't have a punishment. And again, let me just remind you of a halacha. I know you probably all know this, but I just want to be sure. The concept of mamzer, which in English is often translated illegitimate son, is not quite true. If a man and a woman have relations outside of marriage and produce an out-of-wedlock child, in English we might call that child illegitimate. But that child is not a mamzer. There is no problem. That child can marry anybody they want. In order to be a mamzer, it has to be a child that is born from a woman committing adultery or incest, God forbid. So mamzer and illegitimate are not the same status. You could be illegitimate, but halachically you're not a mamzer and you don't have that problem. So, by the way, I don't want to be flippant here. The truth of the matter is, many, many people who are chozrim b'tshuva are technically out of wedlock children, in the sense that if their parents didn't have a kosher halachic marriage, they're not married, right? So, in a sense, many of us are out of wedlock children, halachically, even if our parents were married for 50 years. But that's not a problem, because an out of wedlock child does not have the problem of a mamzer. It's also true that if a child is born from a nido, did not keep taras mishpacha, the child is not a mamzer. That's baruch Hashem, that's a very good thing. A very good thing to know. It's only really adultery or incest. Yeah.
So when they do the act of marriage, when they get married and it's not halachic, they're doing the act of marriage, so they are technically halachic marriage because they consummated together, right?
So that's a big argument, meaning to say there are some opinions that say that even if the marriage was not halachic, if they later consummate, that makes it halachic. There is such a view. But Rav Moshe Feinstein took the other view. Rav Moshe Feinstein took the view that if the original ceremony was non-halachic, cohabitation will not make it halachic. And that's actually very beneficial, because that helps people when the wife doesn't get a get and remarries, the child from the second marriage will not be a mamzer because there was no marriage. It's actually a very helpful halacha. And that's why I myself have officiated. I have remarried couples who have been married for many years. In other words, they were married for many years, but they were not observant, and then they got religious. So they could be grandparents already, but we married them, you know. Chuppah, Kedushin, you know, Brachos, all of those things. So a person can get remarried at any age. If one does not have a halakhic marriage, one should try to have a halakhic marriage.
Two brothers who converted to Judaism, are they counted as brothers now, Jewish brothers, or they not?
No, they are unrelated. So there's no Yibam, for example. If two converted brothers and then one brother married and then died without children, there would be no mitzvah of levirate marriage.
So
the
brother
other
and sister, would they halakhically be like
marriage? Oh, so here you get into a fascinating point. Under Torah law, and this sounds very funny, under Torah law they are permitted to marry. A mother and a son who convert are permitted to marry. A father and a daughter who convert are permitted to marry. But rabbinically it's forbidden, because of Marisayan appearances and the like. So rabbinically, practically, the answer is they're not allowed to, but on a Torah level, they would be allowed to. Now, genetically, it's not advisable.
Say, aunt and nephew sort of thing?
Yeah, whatever the relationship is. That's what I'm saying. On a Torah level, two people who convert are no longer halachically blood relatives to each other. They are physically blood relatives, but halachically they are not. They would also, now that also means there's no inheritance. That's also an important thing. A non-Jew and his wife have a child, right? Everybody converts. The Jewish man has new children with his now Jewish wife. When he dies, the only kids who inherit are the kids who were born Jewish. And the converted son does not inherit unless there's a will. You make a will to give him a share, but he would not inherit automatically because he's no longer related to his father.
What about the other way?
Which other way, yeah.
Like the father's not Jewish. The inheritance for the kids. Oh,
I see. In other words, the father didn't convert to me?
Yes, so the father didn't convert
the wife. Yes, same thing. There's no there's no relationship to the father, actually. Because people don't realize this. If a non-Jewish man who didn't convert has children from a Jewish woman. Now, the kids didn't convert. They're born Jewish, but they're not related to the non-Jewish father. People don't realize that. People just think matrilineal descent just means you're Jewish through the mother. That's true. But it also means you're not related to the father. People don't realize that. When we say Judaism goes through the mother, we are also saying the non-Jewish father is not halakhically related to those offspring. So even if he converts later, he will not be related to those offspring.
So how do halachas like Kibbutz Avraham?
So here we have an important tshuva from Rav Avadya Yosef. Technically, Rav Avadya Yosef writes that technically, if I convert with my father, or my father is a non-Jew, and I'm born Jewish, there's no kibud of yam at all, technically. But Rav Avadya says that if somebody raised you and took care of you, you have a mitzvah of hakara satov. So even if it's not kibud of yam, in fact, adoption is the same thing. Let's take another scenario. It's really the same thing. Let's say we adopt a child. Okay? So the child is adopted. And I don't care if he's a Jewish child that you adopted or a non-Jewish child that you adopted and converted. It's all the same thing. An adopted child, technically he's not my child. There's no kibud aviyei mitzvah. But if I raised him, he does have hakara satov, and he would say kaddish for me and sit shiva for me. But it wouldn't be father-son, it would be hakara satov, which is a very powerful obligation. Okay? Yeah.
So you say kaddish for your non-Jewish father?
It's a big controversy. Many poskim say no. Rav Avadya says yes. So don't represent this as the overall psak. But he did say you can say kaddish for a non-Jewish father. Yeah. Okay. Because of the debt of gratitude. Many poskim do argue with that. But you can certainly say kaddish for a converted non-Jewish father because he's Jewish, even if he's halachically not your father. Okay? Okay, one more question. Yeah.
Differentiating the Orthodox world between Misnagdim and Hasidim, in the sense that is the concept of a Misnagdim even really necessary in to represent the mainstream official world when really you can kind of see it all as one group specifically?
Yeah. You're 100% correct. I even have a funny story to tell you for that. you're 100% correct. They tell a story about a rich father-in-law that married off his two daughters. And he was supporting the sons-in-law for kollel, and the deal was that one son-in-law gets a real fancy fleishik meal every day, and the other son-in-law gets a real fancy milchik meal every day, different times. And the sons-in-law used to argue who is more esteemed in the father-in-law's eyes. And the father-in-law became poor, he could not afford milchiks or fleishiks, all he could afford was potatoes. But the fleishik guy got potatoes in a fleishik pot, and the milchik guy got potatoes in a milchik pot. And they were still arguing who's more chashuv. So the father-in-law said to them, listen, when you got real meat and you got real milk, okay, you could argue, you know, who's more esteemed. But potatoes are potatoes. Potatoes with a meat, little meat taste, and potatoes with a milk taste, it's all the same. So people say, in the olden days, chassidim were chassidim, and misnagdim were misnagdim, and we could fight over it. Now, you know, everybody's potatoes. Potatoes with a chassidic flavor, misnagged with a misnagged flavor, you know, it's potatoes, you know, what's there to fight about? And the emphasis, you can see this, because in a litvashi yeshiva, or Samech technically is a litvashi yeshiva, you know, you can go to a shir, Yisrael Meir Wax, I see there's a shir in the Siva Shalom, and Tanya, chassidish is where I learned, right? You go to a chassidish yeshiva, they'll learn Rav Chaim and mitzvot, meaning the separation is not as great as it was, and we learn from each other, we benefit from each other. So the notion, even the word misnaged doesn't make a lot of sense. The word misnaged doesn't mean non-chassid. Misnaged means opponent, enemy of chassidus. And that's what misnaged means. I mean, are you an enemy of chassidus? You're an enemy, you're a misnaged? So you're right, we don't have to emphasize it so much, but I would still say that, you know, there are differences in orientation, and that's part of the beauty of Klal Yisrael, that we have different ways of serving Hashem. But we don't have to make it very sharp. Now, it depends. Something like Chabad, for example, which you know, Chabad in many ways I admire. I don't mean to disparage, but Chabad's view of the role of the Rebbe is like so much different than non-Chabad that, you know, that's a major difference. But for the most part, you know, we all live within the same basic framework, so we don't have to make such a big deal of all of those differences. Okay, you have a good Shabbos. We'll see you next time.